Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Now, President Bush is acknowledging efforts to help the victims of Hurricane Katrina have fallen short. Bush spoke this morning before heading south to survey the damage along the Gulf Coast.
A lot of people working hard to help those who've been affected, and I want to thank the people for their efforts. The results are not acceptable.
Bush was in part responding to withering criticism from the mayor of New Orleans and others who've accused the administration of bungling the relief effort, leaving people to die in flooded streets for lack of food, water, or medicine. Here's Mayor Ray Nagin on WWL Radio in New Orleans.
They don't have a clue what's going on down here. They flew down here one time, 2 days after the doggone event was over, with TV cameras, AP reporters, all kind of goddamn, excuse my French, everybody in America. But I am pissed.
Well, there has also been criticism of local and state efforts. We're going to have more on the relief efforts in just a minute. But in the heart of New Orleans, people are roaming the streets, stranded without food, water, or shelter. And in the midst of chaos, rumors rule. Earlier today, we called a payphone on Canal Street. Now, we spoke to two people. You're going to hear from Noble Brown. He's a father with five children in tow. But first, we talked to Theodora Herring, who answered the phone. She and her husband stayed in New Orleans when the hurricane hit, and we asked her how she was getting by.
Actually, me and my husband aren't staying anywhere. We've been walking the streets the last 2 days. We're here on Canal Street because we found some seats up here. We've been sleeping anywhere that night catches us on porches and whatever like that where the water is down. So it's very bad over here.
What are you doing for food and water?
People have, you know, we've passed and people have given us water. The military was around at the convention center, the Ernest Morial Convention Center.
Mm-hmm.
There are thousands of people around there, 1,500, I think, or maybe more, that the city was supposed to evacuate out.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are black people, as well as myself,
mm-hmm.
and they were going to evacuate us out of the city to the Astrodome in Texas.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you are a black person. Why did you mention that?
Oh, well, I'm saying because the majority of the people that are at the convention center and at the Superdome are black. I mean, there are some whites involved,
yeah,
whatever, but the majority of them are black. It does seem rather strange that, you know, we can't get any help in here. You know, New Orleans has good people in it, but this, you know, a lot of us are confused. We don't understand it. You know, we're waiting for 20 buses, maybe 30, to come and take out 70,000 or 80,000 people, and the majority of them are black. I own a home, or I did own a home, in the night war. We lost everything. The only thing we have, me and my husband, are the clothes on our back.
You know, you mentioned that you and your husband, with just the clothes on your back, have been sleeping, you know, wherever you can on the street. Is it dangerous?
Well, of course it's dangerous. There are no lights. I mean, the city is in total darkness. There's no water. And certain areas have phone service. Some of them don't.
Hmm.
The area where I live at, the Night Ward area, that area is totally devastated.
Hmm.
I mean, we have nothing down there. And my husband and myself on a two-story home, the water was coming up in the second floor.
Mm. Mm.
And we were going to get in the attic, but then it subsided or it just stopped rising. And we were in water the second floor of our home Sunday to Wednesday. And we were evacuated out. And they said, the buses are going to come and get you. There was no bus. We had to walk miles just to get off the interstate in total darkness.
What have you seen in the last few days?
Total chaos. Total chaos. Actually, we were among those that was at the convention center, and there were shootings. There were looting all the stores. I mean, I don't think there's a store up in the uptown area that has not been looted. There are break-ins in cars. You know, it's just so much damage and so much chaos up there. Someone was raped. Actually, I'm about I'm about 10 blocks from there right now, but I'm not going back there.
Hmm.
I'm not going to put my life or my husband's life in danger to go back there, and so we're just walking around the streets in the area.
We heard terrible stories of elderly people in particular dying without their medication, without water. What was the health situation there?
Well, without water, and the water is rising, the water is contaminated, there are still people in the nursing homes, there are people that are in senior citizen homes that have not been evacuated. Those people are without medical care. Some of them are diabetics. Some of them are on dialysis. It's just so many problems and whatever like that.
We have Thedora Herring on the phone from a payphone on Canal Street in New Orleans. Been wandering the streets with her husband for several days, does not want to go back to the convention center because of the violence there, looting, shooting, and no food or water.
But there's rape going on over there, too.
What are you going to do?
Actually, we've not decided. We know we have to leave, and eventually we will.
How do you leave?
We'll just have to catch one of those buses that's going out, but we're not going to get them now. Maybe when things calm down, and I heard that they were going to allow the buses to come in at least up to 2 months to get the people out, because they still have a lot of people here. Mm. But there's no jobs that we can go to because the city has been shut down. It has been devastated by the hurricane. There's nothing here for us anymore. It's totally chaotic over here.
Do I hear a helicopter in the background or some noise?
Yes. Oh, yeah. We have a lot of helicopters that's flying over the city.
Mm-hmm.
We have state troopers and the National Guard and our own police.
If you would do me a favor, do you see someone there right nearby we could possibly speak to?
No, hold on. Let me
sure, let's see.
If I can get him.
Okay. Hello?
Hello.
Yeah, it's not going pretty good, pretty bad out here. I got my son with me.
It's got to be so much tougher for you that you've got a child with you. What's it been like the last few days?
It's just been survival, you know. It's just trying to get the bare necessities, you know, just having water, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no water here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been really rough, you know, really
yeah.
rough. You know, we're looking for, you know, some people for the, you know, actually come in and do something. Just come in and drop some water down here, you know, some ice, you mm-hmm. know, anything that can turn to water, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, we could afford to get out of here, I mean, when they called the mandatory evacuation, we would have been gone. And the truth of the matter is, you know, they had so many poor people here that couldn't afford to go anywhere. I didn't have a vehicle, and nor did I have, enough money for to get the transportation to go anywhere. It's just it's a disaster, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best way that I could describe it to you.
Mm-hmm.
It was nothing that a person would want to be living in right now, you know.
That's people at a payphone in New Orleans. By the way, they don't have the money to call out, so we took phone numbers and promised to call their families. Well, there are victims up and down the Gulf Coast. Cliff Lansong was a casino worker in Biloxi, Mississippi. He and his family managed to make it out of their home by punching a hole in the attic. We spoke to him from Mobile, Alabama, where a person he hardly knew has offered him an apartment, and he joins us there now. Cliff, how do you manage to find a place for your family to stay?
Well, we met a gentleman over here in Alabama who actually gave us his apartment, a four-bedroom apartment. He gave it to us to live for as long as we needed until we can get our property lined up back over there and find something to live back over on the Gulf Coast.
We're hearing stories like that. I mean, was this a man you knew? He just gave you his apartment?
Well, most of us worked in the casino industry, me and my children, and we went to Evergreen, Alabama a couple of days after the hurricane just to wash clothes and take baths, and it was the closest thing we could find to Biloxi, Mississippi. And while we were there, we just happened to see this man in a Waffle House. And he recognized us and took us under his wing and took care of us.
Yeah.
He was a true angel.
Well, and I understand, this morning when we reached you, you were waiting in a gas line to try to get gas. Now, first of all, what was the gas line like, and why were, obviously everyone needs fuel, but did you have more additional concerns?
Absolutely. The fuel down here is to a critical point. There's lines, the Mobile area, the lines are over a mile long just to get fuel for the vehicles. The Mobile area has electricity. A lot of it has electricity now. Probably 50 to 60% of it has electricity. But there is none on the Gulf Coast. There's no electricity now. From probably Bahala Battery, which is at the mouth of the Mobile Bay, past New Orleans all the way over to Houma, Louisiana. There's no electricity.
Yeah. We understand that you needed the fuel pretty desperately.
My mother-in-law has Parkinson's, and so we it's important for us to be able to get her back and forth to the hospital, and she's in the final stages of Parkinson's. And we have a huge problem down in, on the coast right now with special needs people and invalids, shut-ins, like that, you know, and they're really having a problem.
Yeah.
Right now, you know, if you're healthy and normal, it's still rough on you, but if you have special needs, it's extremely hard.
How was the situation at the hospital?
They're bringing a lot of the people who are on dialysis to Sims, Alabama for treatment, and there was a busload they were loading yesterday to bring to Sims, Alabama for treatment, and they were robbed at gunpoint at the loading point in Gulfport, so they had to delay that one more day until they could bring them over here to Sims, Alabama, for treatment, so they could have their dialysis. The people who have needs as far as medical needs, they're in bad shape. They're hurting right now. I'm sure we're going to lose a lot of people just because of that. But on the radio, we just heard about more people being found alive and dead. And the problem with most all of the people was that they tried to get in their attics when the water started rising. And it rose over the attics, and they were stuck in their attics, and a lot of them drowned there. And the houses were knocked off their foundations, and they're going through the rubble now trying to find it.
Oh, boy. Well, and, you know, you were lucky you got out, but I know you went back to Biloxi to check on your own home. What'd you find?
Well, my home is pretty well destroyed. It got water in it, something knocked off its foundation. Everywhere as you look, I'm on probably the highest point in Biloxi, east of I-110. Everything to the east of me, back into Biloxi, is gone. I mean, it's absolutely gone. The casinos where we worked were decimated. Everything, it's just totally gone. And there's no water. There's absolutely no electricity. Most of the gas was cut off. We don't have anything. We thank God for the people in Alabama, because they've taken us into their homes. They've treated us like relatives, and they're feeding us, and thank goodness for them. They're great people.
Cliff Lanson, resident of Biloxi, Mississippi. He lost his home, moved 6 children and 7 grandchildren to Mobile, Alabama, where a stranger has given him an apartment to stay in. You know, Cliff, you said you'd go to higher ground. I mean, you know, there are other Americans who are wondering if people should ever live along the Gulf again.
Well, our land is, that my house was on, has never been flooded. Ever. I mean, it's my house was built in 1920, and it's never been flooded. So this is something that's never happened before, and it was a total surprise to us.
You'll go back.
Oh, yeah, we're going back. That's our homes. We went back after the 47 hurricane and after Camille, and now after this, and we'll rebuild. We're just trying to find higher land somewhere to build on. And because, believe it or not, it's paradise. It's what we call home.
A Voice from Mississippi. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. And today, a National Guard general said the cavalry is coming. Guard helicopters left the Louisiana State Office of Emergency Preparedness staging area this morning, joined by thousands of Guard members from across the military streaming into Louisiana and Mississippi. But people on the ground, as we've just heard, have a very different picture. One man waiting to be evacuated from the New Orleans Convention Center told the Associated Press that National Guard trucks are not stopping. And there are reports today that police in New Orleans are turning in their badges, not showing up for work, because of fears of armed gunmen. Who is in charge of New Orleans? We're going to pose that question to two analysts. Dr. Neil Livingston is CEO of the security company Global Options, and he's one of the nation's top experts on terrorism. Dr. Livingston, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
And Jane Bullock, professor of risk management at George Washington University, chief of staff at FEMA during the Clinton administration. Jane, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Neil, if you don't mind, I'll call you Neil. We want to go to you first. Yesterday, we had on the program analysts who pointed fingers of blame at the federal government, saying in part that funds to, for instance, fix the levee in New Orleans were diverted to the war on terrorism last year, well documented. Do you agree that that's where the blame goes?
Well, I don't think that's where the blame goes. I think there's a lot of finger-pointing, as there always is after disasters mm-hmm. like this, where the state and local authorities failed to do their job. Look, state government of Louisiana, one of the most corrupt in the country, and the city of New Orleans, also one of the most corrupt and inefficient cities in the country, should have taxed their own citizens years ago to shore up these levees. It was long known that they were only sufficient for a Category 3 hurricane. And so they finally went to the federal government to try to get the money. And even if the money had been appropriated, it would not have been in the pipeline right now anyway. The work would not have been done. Mm. And so I think what we're seeing here is an effort to transfer the blame for their own failure to prepare and address this disaster properly.
Well, Jane, do you agree? And if so, where else do you think state and local officials are at fault?
Well, I actually have a little different perspective on this, Robin. Mm-hmm. I think that the way that the federal response structure for disasters has always been in this country that first we look to local and state, but if their capacities are exceeded, the federal government steps in. We, during my time at FEMA, we always recognized that if there were a Category 4 or 5 hurricane heading towards New Orleans, that the capacities of the state and local governments would be quickly
depleted.
It depleted, and that the federal government would have to be there. And I think that was realized because pre-disaster declarations were made for Mississippi and Louisiana. The federal government had what was required to be able to pre-deploy resources.
Well, we want to point out that now there are some resources being deployed, including one hospital ship leaving Sunday from Baltimore. It's been announced a second Navy hospital ship is going to leave from San Diego next Wednesday and will take 2 weeks to get to New Orleans. Neil, obviously that's going to be pretty late. I want to stay, though, with the state and local officials. Again, we're still in hurricane season, and, you know, much to learn here. What else could have been done, in your view?
Well, I think, as Jane said, that this disaster scenario was well known, had been known for decades. It was even posted on the website for the local emergency management agency in Louisiana. And they pretty much called this the way it happened. So that having been the case, the fact that when they saw that the storm was strengthening, that they were in the eye of the hurricane, they needed to, or in the bullseye of the hurricane, they needed to really pull back resources along the Gulf Coast. I saw, for example, a police station where all the cars were lost and fire stations where all the vehicles were lost, but they were inside of the ocean, and the fact that they were not pulled back away from the tidal surge area was very, very short-sighted.
You're saying pull all basic services inland?
Pull them inland because they can go back very quickly. They're no good to you if they're all destroyed and because you've left them in place. The second thing is, where was the National Guard? I've worked with National Guard and reserve units all over the country, and the fact that neither state seemed to have pre-deployed its National Guard resources effectively. I mean, I looked and looked for a National Guard helicopter down in the New Orleans area. Didn't see one. Looked for National Guardsmen. They should have been in there within the first 24 hours. Stand up the guard in 6 hours.
Jane, I'm also curious about communication. I mean, post 9/11, people were stunned to learn that different services couldn't communicate. Same things just happened in Louisiana. State and federal officials didn't have compatible radios to talk to each other. But still, yesterday, FEMA Chief Michael Brown and Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff did not know that there were thousands of people stranded at the convention center. Everyone knew there were thousands at the Superdome. Suddenly, a surprise of thousands of people at the convention center. Where's the problem there?
Well, I think that points out a very, very clear problem we're having here. Who is in charge of this disaster? And the person that is in charge, the way the system used to work, there was a full information flow up and down. One person was in one person got all of the information and was able to act. I think one of the things that we have to realize is preparations for hurricanes and hurricane preparedness in general has taken a second seat at the state, local, and federal level to preparing for a terrorist incident. And a lot of the resources that would have normally been available to state and local emergency managers to deal with the real risks they face, such as hurricanes, flooding, tornadoes, earthquakes, et cetera, have been put into only preparing for terrorism.
Well, and, you know, as horrific as this is, and, you know, I've been hearing from listeners who are sick to their stomach watching this, but, you know, just the sheer loss of life. But in the back of many minds is, what does this say about our preparedness for another terrorist attack? Or is this isolated, Dr. Livingston, in your opinion, to this one city and a horrific natural event?
I am hopeful that this is going to be relatively isolated. You know, natural disasters tend to either bring out the best in people or the worst in people. In New York on 9/11, a city that's known for it to be rather rough and tumble and abrasive, I think we saw the best in people that day.
You know, I'm going to have to stop you there, and it's a positive note to stop on. Dr. Neil Livingston, CEO of the security company Global Options. We've also spoke with Jane Bullock, adjunct professor of risk management at George Washington University. I want to thank you both, and we'll have you back again to look ahead. But thank you for taking a look at what's going on the ground. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And when we come back, what's now in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast? The devastation from Hurricane Katrina have come questions about the fact that while not all of the victims were poor African Americans unable to leave the city, most of them were. Joining us on the line now, Dr. Michael Lomax, President and CEO of the United Negro College Fund. And Doctor, first of all, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
And we're hearing, you know, all this week from people speaking on the program, people who have long lived in New Orleans, white and black, that the city has been structured this way. It is a city of haves and have-nots.
Yeah, and just as a point of a biographical point, for 7 years from 1997 until June of 2004, I lived in New Orleans as the president of Dillard University, one of our UNCF member institutions. So I come with a a heavy heart and a lot of experience there, and was in the city last week prior to the hurricane.
Yeah, well, and we're hearing that, in particular, the poorer black population is not as much invisible as it is. There's sort of a romantic notion about the way the poor are living, because...
Well, I don't think there are any romantic notions about how poor people live in New Orleans.
Oh, I'm not saying that it's appropriate, but there's sort of this, you know, gee, it's always the way it's been, and it gives part of the city its culture. And of course, there's been criticism of that.
Well, if you lived in New Orleans, you saw poverty on a daily basis. You may have become inured to it, but it was there, it was visible. Certainly not invisible, and it was also heartrending. And you know, New Orleans was not only a city of haves and have-nots; it was a city, and has been a city of where violence and where poverty have been closely linked. And I don't think that what is happening there at this moment should come as a surprise to anyone who knows anything about the city. I think what we're really seeing is a nation that was unprepared for a catastrophe in this environment, and frankly a region that really had not thought through how it would respond to a catastrophe. It had an evacuation plan which was based on people using their individual vehicles to get out of the city. And, we should have known that, one in six New Orleanians does not have a car.
Well, interestingly enough, I am not black, but I have a black house guest watching the coverage together. She said to me, I know you are seeing black people struggling to get out. I'm seeing working class people struggling to get out, that in many inner cities, working class people don't have cars.
Well, and there's yes, working class people and people who do not have jobs. I mean, there's large unemployment in New Orleans. Now, the people who are left behind are also very young. There are a lot of children who have been left behind. There are a lot of single mothers and their children. There are a lot of elderly people who have been left behind. If out there at the Superdome, out there at the Convention Center, these are babies. These are These are kids under five and very old people. There are people in hospitals. They didn't have a plan to evacuate people from hospitals. There were people who were in jail.
Well, because it's being whispered, I'll ask you, do you think there wasn't a plan, and do you think there has been such a slow response because so many of the people are African American?
Well, I'm going to leave that to other people's judgment. You know, the fact, and we can analyze that later on.
Mm-hmm.
Today, there are tens of thousands, and I don't even think we know how many people there are, left inside the city of New Orleans, which is now an island surrounded by water. And the water, I presume, is still coming in. These are people who are in desperate straits. They are in, you know, subhuman conditions, and they are at the extremes, and there still does not seem to be an operational plan to get them out. Most of these people are black. Most of these people have lived their lives in poverty. Most of these people have had very little, and now they have nothing at all.
Well, at least one leading African-American is raising some criticism. You may have heard Illinois Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. Of the Congressional Black Caucus held a press conference in Washington today. When he spoke, he made the point of faulting the media for its coverage of the victims of the hurricane. Let's listen to what he had to say.
I believe and am fundamentally appalled at the idea that this news media has now shifted the emphasis from the devastation that people's lives, people who only owned a pan, people who lived in a shotgun home, people who had one television set, whose lives have been completely devastated by this horrific tragedy. The news media has now shifted the conversation from the devastation that their lives have experienced, that their families have experienced, to what people do in desperate circumstances.
Well, Dr. Michael Lomax of the United Negro College Fund, I want to ask you a question about that. There are some AP photos floating around. I'm not sure if you've seen them. They are real. They have not been jiggered as much as we can tell. Two photos, one showing a black man wading through water, holding up what appears to be Coca-Cola and a plastic bag. Another, almost identical, except it shows a white man and a light-skinned woman wading through water, also holding up bags of food. The caption under the black man says, The caption under the black man says, a young man waiting after looting a store. The caption under the white man says, people wading through water after finding bread and milk in a grocery store.
Yeah, well, that's clearly a caption writer bringing to bear his own or her own prejudices and stereotypes with respect to black people. You know, and the fact is that people in New Orleans are going hungry. They don't have food. They don't have water. There are babies being born that are dying on the streets of New Orleans. There are elderly people dying on the streets of New Orleans because they don't have the basic necessities of life. They don't have water. They don't have food. They don't have sanitation. And in the midst of all of that, there are some people who are breaking down doors and going through windows and trying to get into a Walgreens. And I have seen that same Walgreens footage on Canal Street over and over and over again. That Walgreens has, if there was anything in it, it's gone.
It's been broken into 1,000 times.
Yeah, so, you know, and I think that is a distraction away from what is the root cause here.
And I want to be clear before you go on, it is the same footage over and over
again.
It is.
I mean, yeah. I know where the Walgreens is. It's the same. Yeah. It's the same one.
But you were saying the root cause.
The root cause of this is that a catastrophic hurricane has gone through this region. It has unleashed, you know, torrents of water. People are surrounded by it. They don't have drinkable water. They don't have food. They don't have sanitation. People have been released from hospitals. They don't have access to hospitals. They are dying in the streets. They are asking to be taken out of there, there is not a plan. There are the FEMA, the federal government, the state. The mayor is in anguish. Ray Nagin, I know this man. He is working hours. You know, he's working 24 hours a day, begging
Dr. Michael
for
Lomax.
Someone to come and
president and CEO of the United Negro College Fund. He is begging for someone to come. We know, we've heard him. Thank you so much. Well, members of the U.S. Congress came back to Washington last night to approve a $10 billion emergency spending package intended to cover solely the immediate response to Hurricane Katrina. FEMA is spending $500 million a day, forcing politicians to confront hard realities in an already cash-strapped budget. Well, joining us from Washington now, Gail Chadwick. She covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, we just heard Dr. Michael Lomax from United Negro College Fund saying that his friend, the mayor of New Orleans is begging for people to come. He has used words that we aired on this program, expressing how angry he is at the lack of response. How is this resonating in Washington?
I think the whole country has been late to realize how serious this is, but nowhere as late as on Capitol Hill. I mean, what's striking to be around here today and yesterday is how much talk there is of going ahead with business as usual. Republicans are talking about tax cuts and deficit reduction and eliminating the estate tax and the Roberts hearings, of course, next week. And I just a minute ago got a notice that the Senate Banking Committee will be talking about identity theft. People don't realize the disconnect between what business as usual looks like and the images that Americans are seeing on their television screen.
Can you give us another example of that disconnect?
Well, I think talking to the Republican leaders about what their agenda is going to be, and they said, well, we have to get on with the business of the American people. And, you know, they're talking about Katrina being, you know, an agenda item, but one with many others. For example, Speaker Hastert made a comment to a local paper yesterday that he's been furiously backpedaling on ever since, that he felt that there were, you know, parts of New Orleans that ought to be bulldozed, that could be bulldozed, rather, and he's quickly backpedaling on that to say, what I really meant to say was, we first help everybody that's there, and then we look to see how to rebuild in a way that will make people safe. Now, that's a good way to put the issue, but to say it the first time as, you know, there are parts that ought to be bulldozed, you know, does this, it's a disconnect. It's a kind of tin ear with the human agony that's going on here.
Even though you have Senator Trent Lott of Mississippi losing his home,
A number of members of Congress, some don't even know the fate of their homes yet. Let me give you another example. Bill Frist, on the floor of the Senate at 10 o'clock last night, called the Senate back in emergency session to get money to FEMA. The House is going to be doing that this afternoon. One of the remarks he made was to thank individuals and private groups and faith-based groups for the work that they are doing. And then he said that what refugees need in a situation like this, many more than anything else, is a hug. Now, that remark might be appropriate if you're talking about faith-based in another context, but when the obvious need is water and order, it again sounds like people are taking this occasion to press their agenda instead of just taking a deep breath, realizing the magnitude of it, and going ahead. And I think that kind of tin ear problem is one that I'm hearing all over Capitol Hill today, even as people say, we'll do everything we can.
Senator Bill Nelson of Florida, Democrat, asked the question, is the National Guard depleted because so many Guard troops are in Iraq? Is that question being raised often?
Absolutely. It's the first of many. Let me give you
some. But is that also playing out an agenda? I mean, go ahead.
Well, you could say Democrats are using this for an agenda, but the agenda for Democrats now is vastly bigger than finger-pointing. The agenda for Democrats, and you're beginning to hear some, you know, Harry Reid beginning to talk this way, is to revisit the whole notion, beginning in the Reagan era, that government really was a problem and that the good was to get government out of people's lives. Well, this is one of those cases where government, you can see why it's there. You know,
Gail Chadwick, I'm just going to, we have less than a minute. I want your insight. Congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Is anyone going to resign over this?
Oh, I think you'll, resignations, I don't know. But to my sense, this reopens everything that we've been writing about, control of the Senate and control of the House. This is more than just a few local people or the head of FEMA resigning. That you're going to see in the weeks ahead, going back to ask questions like, why did we spend hundreds of millions of dollars for a bridge that went nowhere in Alaska but refused urgent requests to shore up those levees in New Orleans?
Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. As always, thank you.
Thank you.
More ahead here and now. And as we close out a week of coverage on Hurricane Katrina, we wanted to look at what locals call the language of New Orleans, the music. Fans of jazz and rhythm and blues from around the world are fearing for the future of the cradle of jazz. Well, here's the latest tally. The Neville brothers are safe, but their homes lost, and a Neville daughter, singer Charmaine Neville, is among those missing. Alan Toussaint, part of the city's musical royalty, was last seen at the Superdome. And today, the AP is reporting that singer Fats Domino was rescued from his Ninth Ward home after being presumed dead by his daughter. But what about the hundreds of unknown lions of jazz? Well, Harry Connick Jr. flew from Los Angeles to Louisiana yesterday and drove into New Orleans to walk the streets of his hometown. On NBC's Today show this morning, he asked, if I could get in, why can't more trucks with water get in? And he also tried to convey the scene he confronted.
This is New Orleans, you know what I'm saying? We're supposed to watch this on the Today show and see this halfway around the world. This isn't supposed to happen to us. I feel so in shock.
Well, noted trumpeter Terrence Blanchard is also from New Orleans. You're listening to him right now play the theme from Chinatown. Terrence was tutored by jazz patriarchs Ellis Marsalis, Alvin Baptiste, and Kid Jordan. Wynton Marsalis launched his career, picking Terrence to replace him in Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers. And Terrence joins us now on the phone. Welcome.
Sure, no problem. I mean, thanks for having me on.
I know you have a place in Los Angeles now, but kept a home in New Orleans and family and friends and history there. What are your thoughts as you've watched this coverage?
Well, I mean, it's a bit surreal. I mean, and actually, I was based out of New Orleans. That's where I made my home. I just have a small place in L.A. because I'm out here so much working. Mm. I mean, we still cannot digest the whole thing. I mean, because it just seems to be getting just a little more complicated every day.
Right.
When you listen to the news, I've stopped watching the news today. I've just turned it off. I just don't want to hear any other news. I mean, because there doesn't seem to be anything positive coming out of the situation as of yet. My situation was interesting in that I was out here teaching, and I didn't have cable or access to news here at the apartment just yet. And the day that the cable was hooked up, I looked up and saw that there was a hurricane headed towards New Orleans. I flew back Monday morning because, you see, my wife is from Washington, D.C., and she didn't know much about hurricanes, and she was convinced that she could stay. And I'm like, no, you can't stay. So I flew in at 4 a.m. and put everything that we had in the yard in the garage, packed up the kids, packed up the wife, and we drove straight to Atlanta.
Huh.
You know, Sunday morning, and we stayed in Atlanta for about 3 days, and then we flew out here yesterday.
And just remind those who don't know of how much this city shaped you. I mean, your dad, an opera singer.
I mean, the city itself. I mean, New Orleans has always been an interesting place in terms of the culture. I mean, it has a very strong reputation for the history of jazz. But also, I mean, just the number of musicians that were there, and the number of great musicians. Alvin Alcorn was a guy, he's the reason why I'm playing the trumpet. He's a guy who came to my elementary school and gave a demonstration in traditional New Orleans music. Alvin Baptiste, Kid Jordan, I mean, all of those guys played a big role. Roger Dickerson is a guy who a lot of people don't know, but he is an amazing force in the music community in New Orleans.
But I'm thinking as I hear you list these names and I'm seeing places, you know, music rooms, and I mean, I'm sure you've been thinking about this. A lot of those places, the fear is that they're gone, you know, wiped out.
Right, they're not there anymore. I mean, the hardest thing about watching the news is that I've been, you know, seeing places that I know, you know, mm-hmm. on national TV, underwater. Mm-hmm. And it's a rough thing to take. And it's just a surreal experience. I can't explain it. I mean, you know, it's almost like we're living a bad dream. You're waiting to wake up, and every day you wake up, you just realize the situation is becoming more severe. I feel very blessed that, you know, that I have my family, everybody's okay. But I'm thinking about, you know, all of those folks in all of those neighborhoods, because I know what goes on in those neighborhoods. I know in some of those neighborhoods there are a lot of poor people who couldn't get out. You know, I've been hearing people, you know, I've been walking around L.A. and people have been telling me, why wouldn't those people leave? Mm. And I'm trying to explain to them that, you know, a lot of those folks didn't have the means to leave. You know, they didn't, and where would they go? Mm. They didn't have money to even have a vehicle to leave, or have money to stay in a hotel or stay someplace after they left. Mm. So a lot of those people were stuck. And I know in those neighborhoods that there are a lot of elderly people who we haven't heard from yet. Mm. You know, my fear is that once the water goes down, this is going to become an entirely different story.
But I'm wondering, too, if you're thinking, again, I have to say it again, that's the most important thing, the loss of life. But I'm wondering, too, if you're thinking, you know, the loss of the diversity you're talking about, the what happens in poor neighborhoods when there's a real mix and a stew, and that's what the sound of New Orleans bubbled up out of.
Well, I'm going to tell you, Robin, the more I think about it, the more I start to really feel like I'm not worried about that as much, because New Orleans is the type of town where all of those people, that's all they know how to do. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of the music, in terms of the food, in terms of the culture, mm-hmm. they don't know how to, a lot of those guys don't know much of anything else. I mean, and that's why they're very good at what they do. So I think I'm not worried about the city in terms of, you know, how it's going to come back. I think that will occur. It's just going to be a hard process. I think right now, I mean, music is the thing that saves people's souls. You know, I mean, we have to keep our heads about ourselves right now. I just hope and pray, you know, that the strength and fortitude that all of these guys have had throughout their careers, you know, is going to remain. Because, you know, listen, a lot of those guys never really became big stars. Mm. I mean, there are a number of great musicians who live in New Orleans who do it simply for the love of it, you know. And they do it because they love their city, and they've never left. So I have no doubts about that. My main concern right now is the mental and spiritual health of all of those people down there.
And you're worrying at a distance, you know, you happen to be working in L.A., and I'm just, you know what I'm thinking about, Terrence? I'm thinking about, from your new CD, Flow, the cut Over There.
Written by Derek Hodge, and I said, well, man, what is the title about? And when he started to explain it to me, he said, you know, it's really about how we always look and think that, you know, life is better someplace else. You know, we always think that there's a better life, a better job, a better relationship, you know, better friends, better house, better car over there, and we never really appreciate what we have, you know. And right now, those sentiments are really all the things that are keeping us together in terms of my family, you know, because we're very thankful just to have each other right now, because we could have lost a lot more.
Trumpeter and composer Terrence Blanchard, who was raised in New Orleans, was watching what's going on with the rest of us. Terrence, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And best to you and your family.
Thank you. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com. And by REMAX of New England, a source for real estate assistance in New England, featuring an online renovation guide, agent locator, and comprehensive property search. REMAX-NewEngland.com.
I'm Robin Young.